Thank you, Matthew. Good morning. It's appropriate to be called being human when humans make things go wrong, especially technology, and that's probably going to be me this morning. But anyway, thank you. Good morning. It's a really encouragement to see so many folk this morning, and I trust you're here because you care deeply about children, and if that's true, then we're in a great place together because we're going to spend the next hour just thinking about what is going on with the hearts and minds of our children, and more importantly, perhaps what we should be doing or could do about it. Let me just tell you 30 seconds on me, and then we'll get into some of the content today. So, Matthew said, I'm a child psychologist, so I work in one of the big NHS hospital trusts. But really, I'm someone who just cares deeply about the spiritual and emotional development of children. I had the privilege of starting to work with predominantly teenagers when I was 18. And there's probably been children in my life in some form or another every week from when I was 18 years old. And I see it as a real privilege to be involved in their lives, in particular parts of their journey. I see it as a real privilege. So really, at the heart of me is someone who just cares deeply about children. And if I can infect you with any enthusiasm this morning to do the same, then we'll have achieved a lot together. So I'd like to just start by just putting a little agenda up as to what we're going to try and go through in the next 45 minutes. And then we'll finish with some questions. I would like to just put very briefly a little biblical framework on the table to start with, just to get us thinking in terms of what's our responsibility to kind of model Christ and his truths to the children that we have the privilege of interacting with, whether they're in our family or in our church, or maybe some of us here working professionally with children. Then we'll think a little bit more about their minds, their moods, their motivations. Then I'm going to just share briefly some of the trends. I made reference to some of those yesterday because what we're seeing in particularly children and adolescents is referrals are just, the trajectory is just enormous. And I'll try and explain a little bit maybe what's going on. And then probably the one you're here for. So what parents or grandparents or maybe even what professionals, what would be important things for you to know as you serve and work with children? I don't know the answers to everything. I might have a view. If I don't, I'll happily say I don't know. And then afterwards, there's going to be some time for questions. One last thing then. You'll see on the boards over there, I'm going to be referring to some resources as we go along. So if you've got your phones at the end, on the slide, you'll see a letter. And it's the letter that you need to go to with your camera to then download the resources. If that means nothing to you, come and talk to me, and we'll find out how we can get it to you. And then they're also the same. They're exactly the same. They're on the stage as well. So including a copy of these slides, so you can download those if you'd like to. So let's have a little think then about Deuteronomy 6. Very important to the Jews. Every Jew would have known these words, and every Jew would have seen this as really being important for their children. I am not today going to give a sermon on this, but I think it's good just before we start talking about the health of our children, just spend a couple of minutes just putting a biblical framework on the table just for you to think about. And then, so I'm going to ask you some questions, and I just want you to think about these questions in light of the children that are placed on your hearts today. Because this really is a command. So my first question, and just think about this, my first question then would be, how do the children that you work with or are in your family, how do they see the love of God that you have? How do they see? How do they know God is the most important person to you? Do Do they sense that when you're on the telephone? Do they sense that based on what you watch on TV? Do they sense that from the priorities that you make in your life? How do they know God is the most important person in your life and they can see that kind of day by day? That's tough as parents, isn't it? When we've got to grumble at our kids and remind them of their homework or whatever it may be. But how do you show your love of God? How do you model that to your children? Secondly, then, is that really kind of impressed really within your heart? So it talks about the commands here to love the Lord your God. Do they see that really deep inside who you are, deep within your heart? I've spent my life working in youth in churches, and I asked, so this was probably when we had 70 or 80 in our youth group, and I asked the simple question, what do your parents believe the number one priority is for you? And anyone like to take a guess as to what the number one was? Exams, education. And this is in a big church, evangelical church, and these children were growing up believing that education was their number one. So, and then lastly, the NIV uses this word, impress these commands on your children. The ESV, I quite like the word teach. And some of you, if you're my age or older, teaching probably would have been a concept. You sit in a classroom, someone with knowledge is just talking at you for an hour, and you, the student, are supposed to learn. That's not the model of teaching today, our children. Most children learn with their mouths open. And therefore, my challenge to you would be, is there a dialogue with the children that are on your hearts where you can have a conversation with them about the most important things in your life? And in the work I do with children in churches, what I want to try and do is establish a relationship with them where they sense who and what is in my heart. And then when I've got something to tell them, I hope they're then going to listen because they'll think, oh, he cares about me. He's interested in my life. And therefore, I hope they're then going to listen to me when I've got my Bible open. So just a few thoughts just to kind of put today on a bit of a biblical framework. Because I will look for any opportunity to point a child to Christ. But actually, I first spend time getting to know them and them me, because then that opens up the doors of their hearts for me to tell them about the love that I have inside here. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's then have a think about. So I'm gonna whiz through fairly quickly lots of content in the next half an hour. So I'm really sorry. I'm going to give you a little taster. There's lots more online. I may give you some little phrases that you can then Google and follow up again on online and get some resources. So, but I first, if you want to impress some of your friends when you go back, you could say, well, we did a lot about neurosciences, because I'm going to start off talking about the brain. Because I want you to understand what goes on in the brain of a child. Scientists would tell you that this little chap here has one of the most developed brains at birth. Why do they say that? Because within minutes of being born, it can stand. Within hours of being born, it can walk. Within a week or two, this little chap can run as fast as his mother. And within, again, a few days of being born, it's completely obedient if there's fear. So if a predator comes along, this little guy will run straight under mum's legs and will not move. Because the brain then is developed at birth. Now, conversely, these two little angels, they're not mine, it's from Google. These two little angels, Let's pretend for a minute there's nothing neurologically wrong in their brain. Let's just pretend that for a minute. It could be, but we're not going there today. Let's pretend when these two little angels are born, their brains are perfect. But their brains are a blank canvas. And their brains will just soak up, particularly over the next few years, all kinds of messages about who they are, what they are, and how they should be. Unlike the wildebeest. And if they're a blank canvas, therefore the environment that they grow up in and what they hear and what they watch is going to have a huge influence on how their brain develops. And when we think about the health and well-being of children, so let's pretend these two little, let's pretend they grow up and they hear different messages. Let's pretend one's popular. Let's pretend one's academic. Let's pretend one's good at sport. Let's pretend one has lots of friends. Let's pretend the other one is socially challenged, academically challenged. Let's pretend one or two people at school have got hold of one of them online and is posting all kinds of things online about the second one. And then you can see what happens inside their brains. Their brains are going to start developing different ways of thinking and different ways of believing who they are. And if you fast forward, once you start to get to 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, the little shoots are starting to grow of thinking that's really unhelpful. And if left unaddressed, once they get close to double digits, that keeps growing, it keeps growing. They'll find things online, in many cases, that don't help them, and it will keep feeding the message that I'm not a good person, or I'm not very smart, or whatever. And that's at the heart of what I try and do, because the vast majority of adults, if we went and stopped a whole lot of adults in Keswick today who had difficulties with their mental health, the vast majority would have developed as children. And therefore, we've got to spend more time understanding children, supporting children, helping children, so that their childhood is not stolen from them. And as they enter adulthood, they can enter adulthood looking back with enjoyment rather than looking back into a dark place. Let me talk about mental health for a second, because now I just want to start talking about it. So when does it become a difficulty? So we all have mental health. So sometimes our mental health might be good. Sometimes it may be not so good. We all have physical health. Again, sometimes physically we could be good in good shape, other times not. As far as children and adolescents are concerned, and I've just missed out a slide, sorry, then the emotional cycle of any child is normal, perfect, and we should celebrate it. So if you've got a highly emotional child at home, thank God for them. Emotions are not wrong. They're not bad. It's what we do with our emotions that gets us in trouble. And God has given us these beautiful things called emotions. We can't live life on the top of the mountain all day, all week. But equally, there will be events in our lives that take us into darker places. That's normal. Read Lamentations. Lots of Psalms lament about times that were difficult. That's a normal part of human life. And we shouldn't try and ignore that, suppress that. We should let some of those feelings come out. Now, where I get concerned as a professional is if an event happened and the mood went too low or too long, that's when we'd start to think, what's happening here? And that's where we then start to ask questions. Has something happened that we're unaware of? Or is this showing signs, actually, that a mental health issue or challenge is developing rather than it being a normal cycle that we should be celebrating? Does that make sense? I'm going to now run you through a quick model. Some of you will have seen this before, but I want us to just briefly understand, as a psychologist, the types of things that we're interested in with children. And so there's three parts to this. So the first part is, we've already covered this, we're emotional beings. So we all have emotions, and those emotions, in many ways, will drive us to do things or not do things. We'll come on to that later. Secondly, we all think. Have you ever tried not thinking? Have you ever tried that? That's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? So we all think, and you can't stop yourself thinking. So, and that could be a nice thought, it could be an unpleasant thought. You can't stop yourself doing that. But what you can do is then stop yourself feeding that thought with more and more thoughts. I have an exam tomorrow. That's a thought. Oh, I'm going to fail. That's another thought. Now, I could keep feeding that because I'm rubbish, because I'm useless, because I failed the last exam. So I just keep adding on more and more thoughts onto a thought that was unhelpful. Or I could say, I got an exam tomorrow. Yeah, I failed the last exam, but I didn't do any revision. I didn't try. I didn't work hard. That's not a very good thing. I'm going to work hard to do it. You see the difference in terms of how we think. And then lastly, we do things. Some of the things that we do are good and healthy. Some of the things that we do are not so good and not so healthy. We avoid doing things that are good for us. Going for a walk, meeting with people. But then also we can avoid doing things that are not good for us. So when we talk about we do things, we can do good things and not do good things, but we can avoid doing things that are not so good for us. And what I want to try and suggest to you is that all three of these are linked together. Because the way we think affects how we feel, and how we feel affects what we do, and it's just a cycle. So if you want to understand human nature and you want to understand human beings, this cycle applies to everybody. If we're thinking as a dinner party and no one's going to talk to me, and I don't really want to go there, we'll come up, we might have a sense of fear of the thought of going to something social. So what do? We use an excuse, we stay at home and we do something else as an avoidance. And what I want to suggest is this thinking pattern works positively. If I have a positive thought, that could trigger a positive emotion and might encourage me to do something that's good for me. Equally, if I have an unhelpful thought, then the reverse is true. And most of the patients that I work with are adolescents. And this is a question, this is not a rhetorical question, you can shout out some numbers. What percent of my patients have I found no thinking flaws in the way their mind works? Zero. You're absolutely right. Every single child that I'm working with, when you scrape under the surface, I can find some ways that they're thinking that are not true. And one of the most common things I try and tell children and their parents is everything you think is not necessarily true. everything you think is not necessarily true. But they grow up believing it to be true. If I tell you something enough, you start to believe it's true. And then eventually, if that becomes a fixed way of thinking, you can see how these two at the bottom then start to have an impact. I also just want to show you one other picture. Let me just check how we're doing for time. You'll have seen icebergs in lots of different formats and guises. But I want to talk to those of you where there's behavioral difficulties with children. Because I want to try and encourage you to kind of go under the surface to try and find out what's going on. I won't be the first or the last person to tell you that children communicate to you by their behavior. Their behavior is trying to tell you something that they don't have the words to express, so they're going to kick off and they're going to do something that probably winds you up, but it's their way of trying to say, look, something's not right. And this iceberg, the purpose of this iceberg is that the behavior of the child are the things that you can see. If they're whacking their sibling, or they're not doing their homework, or they're just being absolutely rotten and horrible to you and not speaking to you. Those things we can see. We can see with our eyes. We can hear with our ears. It's visible to us in terms of what's going on. What I'd love all of you to do when this happens is ask questions down here, not just jump straight up to what's going on here. What's going on underneath that's causing them? What are they not telling you about school that happened at school today or happened online? They've just come out of their bedroom and they've just read some horrible, horrible message that they know was about them. But come on, we're grey-haired. They're not going to tell you because we don't understand, do we? Why would they tell you? And something happens, but the vast majority of the time, the answer that you need is down here rather than there being some punishment up here. And that's about kind of keeping the doors open for communication. But let me also just explain one other thing that's really important when working probably with double-digit children. Let's pretend for a second. So next year, I'll have been married 30 years. So let's pretend on the night before I was getting married, I had something going on here in my stomach. Bit of excitement, bit of nerves. And as a 27-year-old man, I knew what was going on here because of what was happening tomorrow. So I can make the join between what's happening here and what's happening in my life. But let's pretend for a minute the children that are in your hearts and minds right now can't do that. And what do we do as adults and as parents and as professionals? We say, what's wrong? And they say, they normally use kind of grunts of two syllables. Don't know. So what you do, and pardon me if this is being rude, what you do then is you just ask the same question in a different words. And the child's thinking, but that's the same question. I don't know. And you start to get frustrated because all you're asking, you know something's wrong, and all you're asking is, what's wrong, and they don't know. And here's what I want you to remember. They may not know. They've got something going on emotionally, but they can't join it together. And that's a dark, lonely, scary place to be when my body's riddled with all of these feelings. I can't join up my day together. And now you're on my case asking me, what's wrong? And I genuinely don't know. And I sense your frustration because I'm not answering your question. and it kind of just spirals. So sometimes our children genuinely don't know what's going on. And sometimes, so we just need to listen to them and hold them rather than necessarily, which is what I do or have done with my two boys, where it becomes almost like an interrogation. Please don't do that. It doesn't work. And then maybe gradually you might start piecing things together to understand what's gone on. And if you're as smart as my wife, she'll just say to me, look, back off, leave them alone. I'm going to feed them in an hour. Ask them the question after I've fed them. And it always works. Now, I've only got boys. I don't know if that applies to girls. But if you've just got boys, don't take them on before dinner. Always ask them questions after food. So that ties in nicely with the posh phrase that we use is called emotional literacy. Now, again, I've worked with kids for 35 years, and I don't know if this is true in the press, so this is just an opinion of me, but I think emotional literacy is getting worse in teenagers. Let me explain what it is. And my wife's not here to use her as an illustration, but my mother is. So I'll use my mum, who's sitting in row two. So as a child, step number one, can I label my own emotions? Do I know what's going on with my body? Can I say, this is what's made me happy, this is what's made me sad, this is what's made me angry? That's called labeling my emotions, reading what my body is telling me, and I understand what each emotion is telling my body. That's step number one. Step number two, which way is it going? Is, so growing up, did I understand how I was affecting my mom emotionally? Probably not, because I was an adolescent boy. But we grow and we develop. So do I have the ability to understand that my behavior is going to affect you emotionally? That's step number two. Step number three is, and now do I understand how you affect me emotionally? And if we tie all that together, then some people use the phrase emotional intelligence, some people use the word emotional literacy. But the point I'm trying to help you understand is, when you're trying to understand a child, just keep this in your back pocket or in your mind, that they may not be able to do this. They may not know what's going on in their body. They may not know that Johnny wouldn't play football with me at break time, and then at lunchtime, everything on offer at lunchtime was not the food that I like. In the afternoon, the teacher then had a go at me. Some children have an inability to then piece all this together and then realize that when I slapped Jack in the playground, it was a combination of all those things that led me to do it. Working with children and raising children, we've got to understand that not every child can do this. And if you're working with children with social communication difficulties, autistic children, they can't do this. And you've got to help them learn it. It's not a natural gift to most children that have social communication or autistic tendencies. And if you're not at least giving them the opportunity to then walk through some of this, you may be making their world a little bit more complex. So let me just pause for a second, because we get an hour to do these workshops, and I'd love to spend a whole day infecting you with the love of children, but I don't have the whole day, so apologies. But what I've tried to do there is just give you some simple frameworks and ideas to understand the hearts and minds of children. Now, I just want to show you a few trends, because this is I work for the biggest mental health NHS trust in the country, and I look after all the specialist services in the NHS, so the ones that children come nationally to in London. And so where I work, all those different services that we have, we've seen between a 30% increase in referrals, and some teams have seen an 80% increase pre-COVID, from today back to pre-COVID levels. So it's just exploding. You all know the money coming into the NHS doesn't match our activities, and I'm really sorry for those of you who are struggling to get into the NHS, because I know thousands and thousands of you are trying, and it just seems harder and harder to reach the criteria. But the honest answer is we don't really know entirely what's going on. We know children suffered more, as well as seniors, through COVID. The changes, some children didn't adapt that quickly to the changes that were going on. They were missing their friends. It gave them even more reason to go online and just spend time online. I don't know if they were always doing work while they're online or whether they were doing other things. But here's a couple of charts. Which you can see it's increasing almost every 2 to 3 years. So I remember reading statistics about 1 in 9 children, then it went to 1 in 7, then it went to 1 in 6. So now we're seeing, for the first time ever, we're seeing 1 in 4 17 to 19-year-olds with probable mental health difficulties. That doesn't mean they've been diagnosed. The vast majority of that increase is girls. And I'd love to talk to you afterwards. If you're a dad with daughters, please don't give in. Please. They need you just as much as their mother. Yes, it can be hard, but the last thing they want is for you to give up on them and think, well, I don't understand them. I'm just going to leave mum to deal with my teenage daughters. So teenage girls is by far the biggest factor in that. Here's another chart which shows you, so this is up into young adulthood. So these are the percentages of children with probable mental health difficulties. And you can see that for young women, it's like over 25% of young women. Now that's just awful. But this statistic here starts down here. And this is why unashamedly I'll take any opportunity to enthuse people to then work with children to prevent this not happening. And back to the very beginning, we have that message of hope, don't we? And at any opportunity we want to bring the hope that comes from a living God and a creator God into their lives, so that, and let's not fool ourselves, we can't prevent them bumping into difficulties in their life. We can't wrap them in cotton wool. But boy, can we equip them ready for the times when they do bump into some of those difficulties by giving them a hope, that a living hope that's talked about in 1 Peter 1, that they need that living hope, that there is someone there to help them. And then probably the biggest statistic that we've seen in recent years, just before I came to Keswick last year, the Tavistock, which is another trust in London, was the specialist team for seeing children with difficulties with their gender. And just 12 months ago, the NHS decided to shut down the Tavistock service, and then it's being moved as we speak. But just look at the increase in referrals from back in 2009, when I think the number was 73, if my memory's correct, And you can see now they're getting over 5,000 referrals. And these are all children. And the big increase is girls who in their teenage years are then saying that I want to become a boy. Now, if any of you are here, I know there's workshops this week. I'm also here next week talking much more about this slide. But then we've got a few minutes now just to talk about, so what should we do? Years ago, I watched this. A patient of mine told me to watch a movie. And a professor of mine, when I was training, said, taught us things that weren't really kind of in the literature in terms of what we should be doing as psychologists. And I remember him saying to us, if you ever get stuck with a child, find out if he or she has watched a movie 5 or 10 times and watch that movie and they will be in the movie. And so one of my patients years ago, I did that. And this was the film that that she asked me to watch. This is Hilary Swank. She played a teacher. And it's been turned into a movie and into a book. And it's called The Freedom Writers. But here's the story of the movie, or the story of the book. And this is really quite profound. She was the daughter of a judge who he wanted her to go into law. And she decided, I'm going to be a teacher in the most in a state school in America with some of the most racial tension going on in that school. Gangs, killings. These kids in the school wouldn't even sit next to each other, never mind teach, never mind like talk to each other. And this teacher went in very naive, this is the teacher here, very naively thinking, well, I need to then start working with these children. And what she did, I thought, was just profound. She bought a load of journals, one for every student in her class, and she left them in a cupboard. And she simply said to these kids, tell me your story. If you want to tell me your story, take one of the journals, and I'm going to leave that cupboard open. You can take the journal. When you've written your story, you can put the journal back. And a week later, she kind of opened the cupboard, and it was full of journals that these kids had gone home and wrote their story. Now, fast forward a few years, all those stories were then turned into a book. And I think the reason why I share this and the reason why I think it's really so profound is all she did to those kids, they were teenagers, they were probably 15, 16 years old, she said, tell me your story because I want to listen. I care. And they did. And then you can watch the movie and see what happens. And the reason why I say that is, if I could do one thing for children, just one thing, I know we're in a Christian convention and we don't talk about genies in bottles, but if God gave me one thing for children worldwide, I would put someone in their life that just listens to them. That's the one thing I do. That's what kids need. I get the privilege of sitting in a room with a child, no phone, no TV, no distractions, and I get 45, 50 minutes to sit with your children. But the vast majority of children that I'm working with aren't doing that with anybody else, even kids within my church. We did a survey a few years ago, 10 minutes was the average when we did a survey amongst kids. How often do you just sit down with someone and talk to them that's an adult? And it was 10 minutes. So if you're a grandparent with time on your hands, just sit with them. Silence is okay. And just build. And I know some of us lose our confidence because we don't know what to say and we don't know how to say it and we'll think we'll get it wrong. But just ask them questions. Be interested in what they're doing. Find something that they understand that you don't understand and say, well, tell me about it. How does it work? How does Instagram work? I've no idea. They'll tell you. Show me the internet. What have you been doing on the internet? They'll show you. So find different ways. And let me just check how we're doing for time. So now there's a bit more advice in the slides that you can download. But I'm coming into land with, and also QR code B is a little PDF. It's a little kind of cheat sheet with 6 or 7 kind of tips and suggestions that I've written to then go with this talk. So that's download B. So I've talked about listening to them. Then secondly, you will earn yourself an enormous amount of credits. Not that we're trying to earn credits with children, but the hundreds of kids, I think I've earned some trust and credit in their life is for the simple reason that what they've told me, I believe them. That does not necessarily mean I agree with what they're choosing to do. And if you think of the gender conversation, that, yeah, I'm struggling. It's a feeling. How can I say a feeling is not right and not real and not true? So that would be bang out of order, both professionally and just in human life. So I can believe what you're telling me, but that doesn't mean I'm affirming what you're choosing to do. So one is about just listening to our children, and secondly, it's about just believing them. Journey with them. I've alluded to this already. Spend time with them. Don't give up with them. And however monosyllabic they are, that's not your excuse to then give up and check out. You can still have a conversation, believe it or not, with a monosyllabic child. I've done it for years. Okay? So don't give up. Then pray for them and with them. There's very few kids I've ever been with in a church setting where I've said to them, can I pray for you? In 35 years, I can count literally on a matter of 2 or 3 fingers the ones that have said no. And that's because their mates were playing football outside and they said, you can pray, but I'm off to play football. It's not that they disagreed with. So just pray for them or pray with them. Look out for any opportunity that you can speak truths into their lives. So I'm a huge fan of writing old-fashioned letters. So I'm always just writing old-fashioned letters to kids. And some of them, they get them out years later and say, this is what you wrote me when I was horrible, when I was 14 years old. Because it has an impact on them. It's impressed these onto their lives. And so I don't send them important WhatsApp messages. If I've got an important message to say, I'll go and get a stamp, put it on an old-fashioned letter, and mail it. So if you've got time on your hands, and not every child is tactile, so I'm not saying you have to go around hugging everybody, but again, if you've got a teenager, then a lot of advice I give to parents, so this is if you're professional, this is not for you. This is for if you're related to them, then just snuggling up and watching some junk on TV, just having physical contact with your teenagers that maybe are not so cuddly anymore, you never know, they might enjoy that. So just sometimes touch is important without there being in-depth conversations. And if they do that, that's not your license to then interrogate them and ask them 100 questions. The intention was to watch some junk on TV together. Lastly then, myths. There's lots of myths when you're working with children. Probably the most important one, especially in a church context, is people that have lost their confidence of working with children will say, too complex for me. I'd be scared if something came up, I'd then make it worse. I've never heard a single example of anyone who's just a great listener making a situation worse. listen, emotionally hold them, believe them, that's not going to make it worse. Then in most cases, it's going to make them feel better. A common one is suicide. Again, it's a myth. Talking about suicide doesn't make children consider suicide more. Then a huge percent of children today will have considered it at some point in their lives. Then again, some of the excuses I hear from parents, well, they're not telling me there's something wrong, so I'm not going to try and create a problem when nothing doesn't exist. Well, that's not the wisest of things to do, because if they've got a problem, they'll find the answer somewhere else if they can't find it from you. And my worry is that answer is online and doesn't have the hope that it might come with you. And some of the children I work with, their most common reason for not telling their parents of some of these difficulties is actually not that, well, they're stupid or they're ignorant and they're not going to understand. The most common reason kids give me is, you've got enough on your shoulders right now, I'm not going to add more onto it. And for that reason, I don't tell you my problems. Well, I'm sorry, but as parents, that is our job. So we've got to make sure that we are available. And the other myth is around social services, although that's getting less and less now. And then quite a few people are always worried that mental health difficulties will prevent you from getting a good job again. I need to stop speaking and hand over to Matthew. So that hopefully gives you a little flavour. And I'm going to leave on this screen, I'm going to leave this slide here. So B is the document that we've not talked about, but you can download that. And C are the resources on the QR codes. Matthew.
David, are you happy to take questions?
Yes, absolutely.
Please raise a hand. I'll bring a microphone round as best I can. I'll look round different parts. I see one hand here.
Thank you for the insightful talk. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, so I'll just kind of verbalise things and just ask you what you think. I'm wondering how true the problem is in terms of the mental health increases. We see the statistics are terrifying, but numbers don't always give us the full picture as to what's going on. For example, you mentioned the gender referrals, terrifying statistics. And yet you also talked about labelling and the difficulties children have with labelling things and how if their parents can't give an answer, they might look for the answer online. Lots of people are suggesting that the gender confusion is a psychological contagion and that many of these young girls, mostly girls, are not suffering gender dysphoria, but they are anxious, confused, depressed, lonely, awkward, feeling out of place. Look for an answer online, find an influencer, gives them an idea. Hence, they start to act it out, maybe. Now, that's been talked about a lot. I wonder how much of that is happening with the increase in mental ill health. We're seeing rocketing referrals. And yet, at the same time, I see a lot of people online, everywhere, saying, we're all getting more mentally ill. People starting to say that normal emotions are actually mental illnesses, anxiety is an illness. We're starting to over-psychologize things. And I do wonder, and this is what I wanted to bounce off you, as to whether I'm going somewhere or not, is just how much of the increase is just talking ourselves and our kids into feeling more ill than they really are. So in terms of the children that you see, have you noticed that they genuinely are suffering from a mental health disorder? Or is there a sense that perhaps they're making a mountain out of a molehill? I just wondered what you think on that.
Wow. There's a few questions there. I think the gender one I'm going to avoid if it's okay, because that's much more than a 20, 30-second answer. And there's sessions this week and next week on gender. But your general question... the honest answer is we don't know. We really don't know. Of course, if there's more people like me, more psychologists, more psychiatrists, are we going to find more people? There is that argument. But the comparisons that have been made years and years ago, they weren't the studies of children to understand how they were feeling, what they were thinking 30, 40 years ago to compare it with. But I can honestly say, in the work that I've done with children, and I know I work in a specialist service, then children today are definitely more complex than they were 20, 30 years ago, without question. And the volume that is coming our way is definitely on the up. Now, I know your volume question is, well, why is that the case? So things like social contagion with gender, we don't see quite the same kind of contagion with other issues. But COVID, for instance, if you take one of the teams that I'm working with in terms of eating disorders, an example, around the country, some of that, it doubled during COVID. Now, we're still trying to unpack why being in a house, locked in, why did that have such an impact on children's, on their body image and on food? We're still trying to unpick it. So my brief answer to your question is, the complexity is there, absolutely, and is increasing. Can we answer the question as to why there's been such a volume increase? There's suggestions, but we don't have a definitive answer. And I think if you take condition by condition, you might find the answer to your question varies a bit. Obviously, you gave gender as one example, but the answer might be different for some other mental health conditions. So I probably haven't fully answered your question, but I think the honest answer is we don't know entirely.
Hi. Oh, it's very loud, sorry. I have a different question. A lot of what you've said, my non-Christian neighbours who love their children and are good parents could agree with. How is what you're saying different as a believer, as a believing minister or a believing parent? What difference does that make to the way we view children's mental health?
Well, as a Christian, and are you talking children as in relatives or children professionally?
Either. So how does you being a believer make a difference to the way you see the problem and the solutions? And I'm a parent. How does it affect the way I should see my children's mental health and the solutions? Does that make sense?
It does. I'll try. I think as Christian parents, accepting that there's difficulty, and to your question earlier, accepting that we don't understand why there's difficulty in its entirety, then my challenge to Christian parents, and raising two boys myself, aware of this, I wanted to make sure for my boys that some basics in their life were there, on top of just making sure they heard the truths of the gospel. So the time that we gave to them and the boundaries we put in place for them. And I know you can read the Old Testament, and it's clear that for our children, we've still got to put loving boundaries in place for them. But why is this important then to non-Christians? I think when you branch into the non-Christian audience, my simple concern today is just the lack of time kids get in conversation with adults. I was out for dinner, I was out for Sunday lunch a few months ago, and the table behind me had two small children, probably 5 and 7. I assume it was mum and dad, just the four of them. The kids were given crayons to colour in, and they got bored within 30 seconds. But I'm not kidding you, 80% or 90% of the time they were there, mum and dad were on their phones. The mum and dad weren't even talking to each other. So my heart aches for kids that are in places where there's no depth, there's no conversation, there's no let's do something because I love you and I want to spend time with you, because I, as a parent, I'm too busy to do that, and I can give you something that will give you a distraction. Yes, you've got your phone, yes, you've got your game machine or whatever, so you're happy, and I've got to do things. So for me, time is the biggest factor that I worry about, both in Christians and in non-Christian homes. So for children, whether they're raised in a Christian family or not, then we need children to grow up knowing that they're loved, knowing who they are and where they belong, knowing that there's kind of forgiveness, knowing that there's some healthy boundaries, so it's not just do what you want, knowing there's consequences for doing things, so that's about kind of the balance of love and discipline. And I think that applies to both sets, really, Christian or non. But in the world I live in professionally, it comes back to time and just listening to them and emotionally holding them through that difficult part of their life.
David, quickly, one more.
Okay.
I've heard that there's for volunteers working in churches, yeah, working with children and young people,
yeah,
there's been a catastrophic decline in those willing to do it for safeguarding.
Tell me.
Just because of the training and fear that we're not actually allowed to sit down and have a one-to-one conversation or build a relationship with a young person anymore.
Right. Rubbish. That is absolutely not true. Point well made. I hear that every week. So, and that's why I made the comment that we can easily withdraw because we don't feel qualified. I absolutely endorse good, solid safeguarding principles in church and professionally. So I don't want you to be in a position where someone could make allegations about you, but equally I don't want children in a position where things could then happen to them. So safeguarding, absolutely. But I think part of it comes down to training, because the point I made earlier, how on earth are you going to hurt or damage a child if you just listen to them? And I think that's the skill we've lost in this current generation, that ability to just sit and listen, tell me a story. And as far as the safeguarding concerns, yes, if they tell you something of significance, you'll have a process that you need to follow. But for those of you kind of my age and upwards, please, 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 if you've got time on your hands, find someone in your family or in your church to just talk to and work with, because the point the gentleman's raised is why so many of us won't do it anymore, because we're scared. We're scared we'll say something that's wrong, or we're scared we'll get into some safeguarding issue that we can't deal with. But that's somebody else's responsibility to deal with. Every organisation should have a safeguarding person, and your job is to tell them and let them deal with it. But please, I hope that doesn't put... I hope and pray that doesn't put you off. Because remember, we've got the message of hope.